16. The next morning, it was time for the rough fitting for Martin's robe. Martin spent most of the night before lying in his hammock, trying to figure out how to handle the Gwen situation. He listed the things he knew. She was the most attractive woman he had met in this time. She was also the first woman he had met in this time. Every attempt he had made to impress her had failed. Gary, Tyler, and Jeff had all asked her out and gone down in flames. She seemed to like Philip, but Philip made a point of not hitting on her. He toyed with the idea of hitting on her by not hitting on her. He would be friendly and professional, maintaining a facade of pleasant disinterest, all the while scheming to initiate a romantic relationship. He plotted and schemed for a bit, but eventually realized that it would be a lot of work, and that he'd most likely mess it up and make her dislike him even more. Instead, he decided to give up. The Gwen thing wasn't happening, and he should just concentrate on his training. Instead of his big, complex bluff, he would just treat Gwen like he would any professional with whom he was doing business. He would be friendly and professional. It was just simpler that way. Martin told Philip he decided not to pursue Gwen.
"Splendid," Philip said. "I'm glad you've chosen to follow my instructions, although it's a shame about the lag time between when I tell you to do something and when you finally decide to do it."
Philip put a bowl of stew down in front of Martin. Martin started to dig in, but paused, his spoon hovering over the bowl.
"Is this still that same pot of stew?"
"It depends what you mean by the same pot of stew. Of course, it's the same pot, and it's still full of stew, but if you mean is it the same stew that's been bubbling away in the pot for days on end, then the answer is also yes."
Martin put his spoon down.
"Are you trying to kill me?"
he asked as politely as he could.
"If I were trying to kill you, you'd know it, because you'd be dead. Don't be such a baby. It's perfectly safe. It's been boiling non-stop for weeks. It's a whole lot cleaner than the bowl I put it in, that's for sure."
"That doesn't help."
"Look, I've added water occasionally and thrown in more vegetables when I get them. This is how they do things here. Didn't you ever wonder how people survived without refrigerators? It was tricks like this. Also, letting the stew cook down over the course of days intensifies the flavors."
"Maybe so, but not all flavors are good," Martin said, eyeing the stew as if it might attack him.
"Look," Philip said, "I told you not to go after Gwen, and after much deliberation, you decided to do as I say. I'm telling you to eat your stew. Sadly, we don't have time for you to decide that I'm right. We have to go and not hit on my friend Gwen."
Once Martin had half-heartedly choked down some stew, he and Philip teleported to the street outside Gwen's shop. It wouldn't have been a long walk, but Philip didn't have any customers lined up, and he didn't like to let a day go by without some public demonstration of his power. Inside the shop, they found Gwen talking to a peasant woman wearing what appeared to be a burlap coat. The woman was holding one arm straight out at shoulder level and was pointing at it with the other hand. At first, Martin thought she was doing some kind of Tai Chi move, but then he realized she was just complaining.
"The sleeves are too long. You don't have to be a bloody tailor to see that."
She had a point. Her fingers were barely showing beyond the line of the cuff. Gwen looked perplexed.
"Are you hunching your shoulders?"
"Are you calling me a liar?"
Gwen held up her hands.
"No, not at all. I'm sorry, I'm just mystified. Cloth shrinks, it doesn't grow. And even if it did, it wouldn't grow faster in one direction than in the other."
"Well, it is. I just bought this coat 3 months ago, and now it doesn't fit."
"We both agreed it fit fine when you bought it."
"Well, now it don't."
Gwen thought a moment.
"You live near to Sam, don't you?"
"We both live in Rickard's Bend. What's that got to do with anything?"
"Nothing, I'm sure. Look, I'm sorry for the trouble. Leave the coat with me. I'll hem the sleeves for free. Please come back in a week. It'll be done."
The woman handed Gwen the coat and left. As she passed Martin, he heard her mutter,
"Now to go settle up with that bloody cobbler." "Tough morning, Gwen?"
Philip asked.
"Nothing I can't handle so far."
Gwen looked pointedly at Martin. Martin smiled.
"Good morning, Gwen. It's good to see you."
Good morning, Martin. So, gentlemen, ready for the rough fitting?
Gwen asked Martin to remove the blood-red loner robe and hat. She unfolded a robe made of thin, off-white cloth, which he held up like a man helping his wife put her coat on. As Martin slid his arms into the robe, Gwen explained.
This is just a rough template I made to your measurements. Once this fits properly, I'll make the real thing out of more expensive fabric.
Martin swung his arms around.
How's it feel?
Gwen asked.
A little tight through the chest, but other than that, it feels good.
Gwen made a note. She pulled at the seams where the shoulders met the sleeves, held her measuring stick along the side of the sleeve, and took another measurement.
The shoulders aren't sitting quite right either.
Martin said,
It'll be fine. You know what you're doing.
What fabric have you chosen?
I have a couple of ideas. I didn't want to settle on anything until I saw your staff. Or are you the wand type?
With great effort, Martin let this pass without comment, simply turning to Philip and asking,
Could you please hand me my staff?
Philip took the staff Martin had left leaning against the wall and handed it directly to Gwen. She looked at the small bust of Santo in his shiny silver mask.
Fearsome,
she said.
What is it?
Martin puffed up a bit and explained.
That is the grim visage of the saint of the southern country, destroyer of monsters and leader of men. He vanquished and later befriended the blue demon.
It was the first time Martin had gotten to use the description he'd prepared, and he was pretty happy with it. Gwen seemed impressed. Gwen put a conical hat made of the same flimsy fabric on Martin's head. They discussed how it fit. Gwen took a few more measurements and told Philip and Martin to come back in a week for the final fitting, and if no further revisions were needed, they could take the robe home then. As they left, the angry woman with the oversized coat came back in, now barefoot. Her leggings were stretched down past her heel onto her foot. She said,
You got me so angry talking about the coat, I plumb forgot to mention that my leggings are too long as well.
Martin and Philip returned to the hut and worked until that time of the day when it was almost not the day anymore, but it wasn't quite night yet. The sun was still in the sky. It was low in the sky, but it was there. When it finally went down, the world would have a brand new night, with all the promise and opportunity that a night offers. But the world wasn't there yet. Before the new night could begin, the old day had to end, and it was grinding slowly to a halt. Birds were singing, quietly. Rabbits were mating, tiredly. People were doing their work, half-heartedly. In Philip's hut, he and Martin were just finishing up a discussion about transporting complex objects, a complex problem, which Philip could tell was completely failing to hold Martin's interest. Philip was annoyed by this until he realized that he couldn't remember what the last sentence he'd said was, because he'd been more interested in obsessing about Martin's lack of interest.
Let's break for the day and have dinner, Philip said.
Great idea,
Martin replied. Philip stood up, walked over to the stew pot, turned and saw that Martin had walked the opposite direction and was standing next to the door with his staff in hand.
Where are you going?
Philip asked.
To get dinner, Martin answered.
But we have stew here,
Philip said.
That's why I'm eating somewhere else,
Philip said.
What do you think you're going to eat?
Anything but stew?
Martin left before Philip could protest any further. Martin didn't wish to eat any more stew, but he also wanted to stretch his legs and see more of the town. If he just said so, he was sure Philip would have gone out for a walk with him, which would have been nice, but not as nice as going alone, because part of his view of the town would have been blocked by Philip, and he had seen Philip enough. Philip's hut stood near the edge of town. So, of the four directions Martin could walk, one led out into the woods, two led along the outskirts of civilization, and the last would take him into the heart of Ledchurch. Martin set a course for the center of town and started walking. Martin knew that he cut an imposing figure in his borrowed blood-red robe and hat, carrying his staff with the fearsome visage of Santo staring out at the world. Martin tried to balance this by smiling and appearing friendly. But as he walked down the street, he found that the people who were still out milling around gave him a lot of room. They didn't seem unhappy to see him, just happier to see him from a distance. Martin thought about his dinner options. He could go to the rotted stump and buy some food,
But given the first impression he had made on the owner, he didn't like his chances of getting clean, unadulterated food out of that place. Frankly, he didn't like anybody's chances of getting unadulterated food from Pete. But he figured any food that Pete knew was going to Martin would probably be pretty adult by the time he got it. Martin decided to turn right at the next intersection, then left at the one after that. Instead of walking directly to the center of town, the same way he and Philip had before, he would go via a slightly different route. Ledchurch was small, but there were still parts of it he hadn't seen. Martin wanted to fix that. Martin thought, there must be somewhere to buy some food in this place other than just the rotted stump. He was sure he'd seen a guy selling fruit and vegetables out of a cart the other day. Of course, he probably irrigated it with filthy water. But I can always wash whatever I buy with the local water, which is also filthy. Martin realized that he hadn't thought this little expedition through very well. He considered going back to his own time to get some real food. The problem there was that he didn't have full shell access, so he couldn't use whatever simplified tools the local wizards had developed for time travel. He could edit the raw file directly, which was possible, but difficult, using his phone's tiny screen and twitchy on-screen keyboard. Time travel and teleportation were not activities in which one wanted to risk a mistake. His safest option was to use his app, which would always take him back to the exact time and place from which he last left, so that would mean raiding his parents' fridge, which would be awkward, given the fact that federal agents were laying siege to their house. I could have something delivered, a pizza or Chinese or something, he thought. I wonder if the delivery guy would fight his way past the treasury agents if I promised to tip him an extra 20. Martin was so delighted at the image of a minimum wage pizza deliverer elbowing his way past armed law enforcement officers that he forgot to pay attention to where he was going. He didn't collide with another person or walk into a stationary object, but he suddenly looked around and realized that his surroundings had changed. The light seemed dimmer. The huts that lined the road were less well cared for, and many didn't seem to be structurally sound. The animals looked malnourished, and what carts he did see were not in good repair. His fellow pedestrians were the most unsettling part. They weren't doing anything overtly threatening, but they were all watching Martin like a hawk.
Stay cool, Martin told himself. There's nothing to worry about. I'm a wizard, after all. Just keep walking, act like you belong here, and you'll be fine. Of course, I don't have all of my wizard powers yet, but none of these people know that. Someone would have to be pretty stupid to pick a fight with me. Or a really, really good fighter. Or possibly both.
A voice from across the street called out.
Hey, are you?
Martin had never in his life had a sentence that started with, hey, you, and in a way that made him happy. Despite this, he reflexively turned toward the voice, regretting it immediately. Across the street, he saw a huge man, both tall and broad, built out of solid muscle in exactly the way that makes a man look terrible with his shirt off. Fortunately, he was wearing a chainmail vest. Unfortunately, his prodigious chest hairs were poking out through the mail, giving the viewer the impression that the chainmail was blurry. Several other young men who were smaller than the big guy, but still larger than Martin, were hanging around. Martin had seen their type before. Really, anybody who attended public high school had. They were tough young thugs, looking for a good time, and the easiest way to find a good time for them was to make sure someone else was having a bad time. Martin and the big man locked eyes. He gave Martin a look that said both, "How dare you look at me?" and, "Yeah, you better look at me when I'm talking to you." He started crossing the street, walking directly toward Martin. Big patches of the man's hair were missing. Martin wasn't sure if they'd been pulled out in a fight or fallen out due to some awful illness. The big man smiled. Several teeth were missing, and Martin still wasn't sure whether to blame violence or disease. The man's nose looked like it spent more time broken than not. The big man walked up to Martin, standing close enough that he couldn't be accused of touching him, but couldn't be prevented from it if he chose to. He kept his eyes locked on Martin, but turned his head slightly, as if talking over his shoulder to someone behind him.
"Hey, boys, look who's here. This must be that new wizard we heard about."
The other punks filled in all around, surrounding Martin on both sides. They were all smiling. None of them looked friendly. One felt the fabric of Martin's robe. Another repeatedly flicked the point of Martin's hat. A third looked at the bust of Santo at the head of Martin's staff and made a face, growling at the masked luchadore. The big one said,
I hear the town wizard is teaching you. Is that right?
Maybe you'd like to practice on us, huh? Show us what you've learned. Does that sound like fun? I think it does.
Martin mentally ran through his options. His brain was in high gear, burning through ideas so quickly that it didn't even form words, just a stream of concepts. He could try talking to them, but that's exactly what thugs like this wanted, to prolong things and make you squirm. He had his phone, he could use it to hover or teleport, but hovering was useless, and any way to teleport he'd have to pull the phone out and turn it on, which would just give them the opportunity to try to take it from him. He'd have to use the powers he'd already been taught by Philip. He was invulnerable. He could just let them pound on him until they got tired, but that didn't sound like fun. He could copy things. Of course, copying the thugs would be counterproductive, but he could copy a bunch of gold pieces and buy them off. He dismissed the idea immediately. It was cowardly and would have just given them incentive to attack him again. He could levitate objects. He remembered Philip tormenting him with the flying goat. Martin held his staff in front of himself, said, Levi Objecto, then shoved his staff forward with both hands. The big guy flew backwards and rolled to a stop in an undignified heap. Unfortunately, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. And while there were ways to counteract this, Philip had not yet seen the need to teach them to Martin, since he had only levitated very small objects. The act of shoving the brute had also shoved Martin backwards even farther. He instantly realized what had happened, but was helpless to stop it. He slid to a stop on his backside. Looking up, he saw the smaller thugs, still standing right where they had been, but with a gap in the middle where Martin and their leader had flown away. Beyond the gang standing there with their mouths hanging open, Martin saw their leader, slowly lifting himself out of the dirt with murder in his eyes. One of the smaller gang members said,
He knocked down Kluge!
In an awed voice. Martin had to think fast. He had one power he could use as a weapon, and it seemed to have a fatal flaw, but perhaps he could turn it to his advantage. At the end of the street, directly behind the one they called Kluge, who was now on his feet and walking toward Martin with terrible purpose, Martin saw a tall, sturdy-looking tree. Martin leapt to his feet, pointed his staff at the upper branches of the tree, and cried, Levi Objecto! The tree did not move. The thug sneered and laughed.
Good, Martin thought.
He hauled back on his staff as if it were a fishing pole and he was trying to land a marlin. If the tree had been floating in the air, this would have pulled it toward Martin with great force, but it was not. The tree was rooted to the ground. So instead of the tree being pulled toward Martin, Martin was pulled toward the tree. Martin streaked through the gaggle of punks, who flew in every direction. He hit Kluge directly in the chest with both feet, knocking him back down into the dirt. Martin's trajectory flattened, and he slid to a stop on the dirt road, barely managing to stay on his feet. He released the levitation spell and looked behind him. The thugs were struggling to their feet. Kluge rolled over onto his stomach and looked up, locking eyes on Martin, who sprinted back to the main drag and nominally familiar territory. He turned right at the next intersection and was back on the same street he and Philip had used to walk into the center of town. From here, he'd be able to find his way back to Philip's shop, Gwen's shop, or the lead church. But before any of those things, he knew he'd find the ramshackle fruit stand he'd been seeking for very different reasons just a few moments ago. Martin was aware of several very heavy-sounding sets of feet running behind him. He knew the gang was chasing him, and he suspected they were gaining ground. As he got closer to the fruit stand, he saw the very thing he'd been hoping for. Pumpkins! Martin slid to a stop, a calculated risk, but one he had to take. He aimed his staff at a large pumpkin, said, Levi Objecto, and raised the staff over his head like an axe. He saw that the pumpkin was obeying his command. He pivoted, observing that the gang was still about 50 feet behind him. They had been gaining, but now, seeing him standing his ground with a blunt object in his hand and a heavy-looking gourd hovering above him, they screeched to a halt. Martin leveled his staff directly at the leader, Kluge, and the pumpkin streaked straight at him. Martin aimed for his chest, specifically for the two muddy footprints that marked where Martin had bounced off of him before, but Kluge turned and blocked it with his arm, the projectiles exploding in a cloud of pumpkin rind and guts. The rest of the gang shielded their faces from the residual flying seeds and goo. Martin turned, levitating a second pumpkin, which he spun in an orbit around himself, swinging his staff like a samurai sword. He picked out the second largest thug, then pointed his staff at him. The thug knew what was coming and dodged, but the pumpkin still struck the smaller man behind him, knocking him off of his feet with an undignified yelp. After that, everyone scattered. Even the man who'd just been struck crawled quickly, then shambled to his feet before limping away as fast as he could. The only one left was Kluge, rolling on the ground, moaning. Martin turned his back and walked casually to the fruit stand. He asked what he owed for the two pumpkins, paying the total from his coin purse. As he handed the gold to the fruit seller, he saw fear in the man's eyes. Martin turned to see Kluge, who was nearly on top of him, holding a large rock over his head. Martin stretched out his hand and again said, "Levi obiecto!" He lifted Kluge into the air, spinning and cursing. Martin braced himself against the pushback and gently sent Kluge drifting away down the street and high into the air, as if he were a helium balloon, and Martin had simply let go of the string. Martin said, "Drop the rock!" Kluge shouted and cursed and threatened to do a lot more than that if Martin didn't put him down. "Drop the rock!" Martin repeated before adding, "Or I'll drop you!" Kluge dropped the rock. Martin looked at him, floating in space, shouting obscenities. He drew Kluge in closer so they could talk.
"Really, he's a lot like the goat that Philip levitated," Martin thought. "He chased me around, he's unpleasant and nasty, but in the end, he's really no threat to me at all."
He brought Kluge in close enough that he could almost reach out and grab him. Almost, but not quite. After trying several times, Kluge gave up and simply hung there, giving Martin the eye.
"This ain't over, wizard," he said. "Me and me boys will be watching you. Count on it."
Martin smiled.
"I hope you do watch, and I hope you pay close attention to what you see, because as long as you see me with this staff here in my hand, there's nothing you can do to hurt me."
Martin lifted Kluge high into the air, then sent him far into the distance toward the tallest building in town, the lead church. Kluge grasped the steeple with both arms, and Martin released him. Martin saw him slide down the steeple, heard faint, distant yelling. He looked around and for the first time saw that the street was lined with people who had seen the entire exchange. Martin thrust his hand into his robe pocket and grasped his phone. He craned his head and peeked at the screen through the voluminous pocket's opening. While his app booted up, he looked up and smiled at the villagers, who were still watching him silently, out of fear and shock. Martin glanced back down at the phone, chose the teleportation function, and estimated the location of Philip's hut. Martin looked up, smiled brightly, tapped the brim of his wizard hat with the head of his staff, and disappeared. Martin reappeared at the far end of the road, about 30 feet beyond Philip's hut. He quickly scampered to the door and ducked inside. Philip was still sitting at the table, reading an old issue of Omni magazine. He looked up and said,
"Back so soon?"
Martin said,
"Yeah, I decided Stu sounded pretty good."
The next afternoon found Philip and Martin in an empty field miles from town. The field was bordered on one side by forest and on the other side by the sea. Philip was carrying what looked like an artist's easel and a large dartboard.
"Today we're going to talk about mystical rays and beams," he said as he set up the target with its back to the sea.
"How long did it take you to get used to saying things like that without feeling silly?" Martin asked.
"I'm still working on it. Anyway, you already know how to levitate small objects and move them through the air. That alone is one of your most powerful defensive weapons. But in an actual fight, simply hurling heavy objects at people leaves something to be desired."
"It's not that impressive," Martin agreed. "I mean, making things float is cool, but everybody knows we can do that already. And at the end of the day, there's not a lot of difference between throwing a rock at someone and magically throwing a rock at someone."
Philip nodded.
"That is one issue, but the more immediate problem is that it could kill them.
If it's in self-defense, that's one thing, but our goal is to prove that we have powers, not to prove that we are murderers. The beauty of mystical beams and rays is that you can make them look horrifically violent while being deliberately non-lethal.
Philip and Martin stood about 100 feet from the target.
Okay, Martin. You're wearing a robe and hat. You've got your staff. What's the first rule of using your staff?
Don't make the obvious joke.
Top man! Now, I want you to stare at the target. Concentrate hard on it. I want you to say, Radion de Ruja Lumo, when you'll think you're ready.
Martin stared at the target. It seemed to loom impossibly large in his perception. He imagined it being obliterated by his will. He exhaled slowly, and when his lungs were almost depleted, he said,
Radion de Ruja Lumo.
An awe-inspiring amount of nothing happened. Martin turned to Philip and pointed at the target.
It's still there.
What'd I do wrong? Philip said.
Say it again.
Martin furrowed his brow.
Say what again?
Radion de Ruja Lumo?
A bright beam of light, the width of Martin's arm, shot from Martin's pointing hand directly into the target. Martin gaped at it for a moment, then let out a whoop. He raised his hand to look at it, and the ray angled into the sky. He aimed it back at the target, then at the ocean, then at a tree, then at a rock. The whole time he was giggling like a maniac.
As I said, Philip said, the shell is always monitoring us. It's not just waiting for commands, it's also looking for signals. Of course, it won't let you do anything without a staff, a wand, a robe, and a hat. But there are subtle clues as to your intent built into those items. The robe has 2-foot cuffs because that's how the shell knows where your hands are. It watches for you to make a pointing gesture, and that's how it knows where to target things. It took us a few years to get the programming right. For a long time, we could only shoot beams from our staffs and wands. You can still use your staff to shoot rays if you like. It can look very impressive, and can help with long-range accuracy if you hold it like a rifle. Also, if you think you're ready, you're welcome to stop shooting me with your beam.
Martin laughed and changed his aim so that the ray was no longer hitting Philip in the chest. He aimed at the grass between them. The ray brilliantly illuminated a 4-inch circle of grass, but was clearly doing no damage.
I assume this is some kind of harmless learner's energy beam?
Of course. Your hand is a glorified flashlight.
Still, it's awfully cool. Thanks for showing me how to do this.
You're welcome, Martin.
They stared at the spot of grass illuminated by the beam.
Phil, would you show me how to stop it?
Sure, you know how already. What's Esperanto for stop?
Martin laughed at himself and said,
Halti.
The beam disappeared.
Okay. Now we're going to move on to something genuinely dangerous, so no kidding around.
Gotcha.
Good. I want you to carefully point at the target and say, Radion de Varmo, when you're ready.
Martin did as Philip told him, and the target burst into flames.
I can't see the beam, he said.
That's right. Simple beams like the ones we've been playing with usually either look cool or do something useful, but not both. If you want to accomplish something and look good doing it, you have to shoot more than one beam at once. You could tell the shell, beam of heat and light, and make a loud noise, and surround me with sparkly stuff. But that's a lot to translate into Esperanto on the fly. That's why the next thing we study will be making macros.
Cool,
Martin said.
Why isn't my hand burning?
We built a safety feature into the shell. The ray, all rays, actually, start 3 inches beyond your hand.
Philip pulled a long blade of grass out of the ground and touched it to Martin's pointing finger. It was unharmed. Slowly, he moved the blade away from Martin's finger toward the target, and at the 3-inch point, it burst into flames.
Mind if I stop?
Martin asked.
Feel free,
Martin said.
Halti!
There was no visible difference, but he pointed at the ground and the grass was unharmed, so clearly the beam had stopped. He looked at the smoldering ashes of the target.
Sorry I destroyed your target, he said.
Philip patted him on the back.
Don't be. I borrowed it from Gary.
Later that afternoon, Philip and Martin sat at the keyboard of the Commodore 64. Philip removed the crystal ball and put the monitor, an old 11-inch color TV with a faux wood grain exterior, up on the table so they could both see it. Philip said,
"You remember the night we met? That display I put on before I sent you flying into the trees?"
"Yes, I remember that."
"Well, that was what we call a macro. I'm sure you're aware of the idea of a macro."
"Yeah," Martin said. "It's a simple program that allows you to execute several actions with one command."
"Exactly. That's all that was. I sat down in advance and thought up an entertaining series of commands and programmed the shell to execute them for me if I do certain things. In that case, I twirl my staff and quietly hum a few notes of Ride of the Valkyries. We all program our own macros. Some are useful, some are for show. When we get together, sometimes we have a duel to see whose macro is the most impressive. You could say it's like breakdancing for wizards."
"I could, but I like you, so I won't. What was that you hit me with, by the way?"
Philip shrugged.
"I can't tell you all of my secrets. But since you've experienced that particular beam firsthand, I suppose there's no harm in telling you that the active ingredient was a 1-foot-wide column of wind."
"Wind? I was blasted into the forest by wind?"
200-mile-an-hour wind.
"Yeah, I guess that'd do it. So, how do I make a macro?"
"It's just a matter of basic computer scripting. I'm sure it's nothing you can't handle on that pocket computer of yours."
Martin pulled out his smartphone, looked at it, and bit his lip.
"Bill, I've done some programming, and the thing is, I could probably write the macros on this, but it wouldn't be a lot of fun. This isn't really a computer. I mean, it is really a computer, but in my time, we really don't use these as computers."
Philip looked confused.
"What do you use them for, then?"
"They really haven't told you anything about the future, have they?" "This is my phone."
"A phone? You use it as a phone? You carry around a device that's the size of a deck of cards and is more powerful than a Cray supercomputer, and you use it as a phone?"
"I also play games on it and watch a movie occasionally."
"You can watch movies on that?"
"Not many. I mean, I only have a 16-gig memory card in it."
Philip muttered, almost to himself.
"My Commodore has 64 kilobytes of memory and a floppy drive that stores 170K. You can double that, but you have to cut a notch in the disk."
Then, loud and clear, Philip said,
"I kind of hate you right now."
"I guess that's why nobody tells you about the future."
"I guess. Anyway, that'll have to wait. We have some work to do this afternoon."
"What kind of work?"
"Nothing too taxing, just a quick exorcism."